Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect introduces Barbara Fishbane German.
She's a social worker for the last 25 years. She's at Holland Bloorview Kids Rehabilitation Hospital.
That's correct.
And she's appeared in the Star identifying families with children with disabilities as having financial problems. And this was something that struck me, Barb, as something I was familiar with but hadn't made the connection between families with disabilities and financial problems as a direct connection. I welcome you to the show and hope that we can understand it better.
Thank you, Jeff.
Now, what was the issue? Was housing, wasn't it, that made you bring this to the Star or made you were answering questions in the Star related to housing?
Yes, I was. And I was participating that day in a rally related to affordable, accessible housing.
Right.
In particular with a focus on children with disabilities and their families.
Right. And who was sponsoring the rally?
The rally was really an umbrella group of organizations, of advocacy groups across Canada,
mm-hmm.
who were looking at the issue of affordable housing.
Do they have a name?
The Toronto group is the Advocacy Centre for Tenants Ontario.
Okay.
And there are a number of groups that were working together with them.
So they're not all government funded like Legal Aid in Toronto?
Not necessarily. They're not all government funded.
Okay.
No, and they that rally was, it was called the Red Tent.
I recall.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you regard it as a success, that rally?
Certainly it was a success and continued to be one way of raising awareness around this issue. And really what they're looking at is trying to change legislation. And as far as I know, the bill that they were referring to has gone to third reading, and that is deemed a success in terms of looking at the fundamental rights and freedoms of all Canadians and including
housing. Yeah. So it looks like this bill will go through?
Well, it
still depends on the bloc, doesn't it?
Yes, you're right. Absolutely. Absolutely. It certainly does. I'm not sure where it is now, but when I last had heard from the group, it was moving forward, but I don't know how quickly it going to move in government.
What was it that drew your attention to families with disabilities and poverty and the link between the two? I mean, you work as a social worker, you must have seen things that made you aware.
Absolutely. As you said, I've worked in the field for at least 25 years, and I have had real experiences of families living on a day-to-day basis, and in particular the area of affordable housing. Many of our families have been paying a tremendous amount of their income, particularly lower income families, towards the cost of housing and paying market rents for that, and have been on waiting lists for social housing, affordable housing, for at this point, officially in Toronto, it is 10 to 12 years, and I think you mentioned that it could even be longer, and that's correct.
I'm almost certain that it's longer because I've been on that list myself for longer than 15 years and wrote them that I was disgusted and was stepping off it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And certainly as a professional person trying to assist families on a day-to-day basis, it became very clear to me that this was not an isolated incident.
Right.
That there were groups of people, numbers of families that were really struggling, and they would come to me over and over again, and I would say, let's look at what your needs are and what is the most important priority, and let's start there. And oftentimes they would say, well, we need housing, and that's the first thing.
Yeah.
And then everything else we can deal with, we'll begin to deal with, but we need a place that's safe, that's accessible, and that's affordable.
You and I were talking about this before, and we mentioned that these families are impoverished apparently two ways, they lose out because they're paying market rents on far less than market incomes, but they also lose out when the money that they have to pay to rent in most families would normally go to other things.
Right.
Transportation, recreation, food, clothing, education, anything else that's normal in family life would suffer if you're paying too much money for the rent.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are certainly extraordinary costs related to raising a child with a disability, and there are more costs for transportation to medical appointments and transportation in general, as you mentioned, equipment, you said education, and
yeah.
I'm sorry, there are certainly a number of those things.
And so it seems to have fallen to these families to rely on charitable groups to supply many of these needs.
Certainly, and I think, you know, I have to be clear, and we've talked about different types of programs that are offered through the government, and there is a program, there is an allowance called Assistance to Children with Severe Disabilities.
Oh, yeah.
And that is a monthly allowance that families can apply to. It is income tested.
Okay.
Now, quite a large group of families are going to qualify for that program. That is a very helpful program that looks at all of the costs that we talked about that are associated.
So the threshold for this, for the income testing for this program, doesn't appear to be punitive from what you say.
Not necessarily, but if you are middle income to perhaps low income, of course, then you may, if you're just above that threshold, you may not qualify, and therefore you are certainly taking on all of those added costs. And I have to say that there are some other programs that are specifically related to some of the things like renovations and modifications, which is through the Ontario March of Dimes.
Yeah.
And there are some other funding.
You mentioned President's Choice, too.
President's Choice Children's Charity is a private foundation that has provided a lot of support to our families, as well as the Jennifer Ashley Children's Charity. And they have particular things that they will provide assistance with. Yes.
Okay.
Again, when it comes to those private charities, it is income tested.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, only families that are at a certain level of income are going to qualify for those programs.
This one-step income testing seems to be a little brutal, doesn't it? The qualification needs to be a little bit more like income tax, pardon the expression. If your income is above a certain threshold, you maybe get less assistance, but it seems to be problematic. If your income is above a certain threshold, you are just that far away from getting all assistance, but you get none.
That's right, that's right. And, you know, those are the families, sometimes they might have two or three children, they have a mortgage to pay, they have lots of added expenses, and therefore it can be very hard on some of those families who are in that middle range, absolutely. They, you know, there are some things that are not income tested. However, one of the primary resources that was available to families called Special Services at Home, that was not based on income, but that all children with physical and developmental disabilities would be eligible for, and that is an amount of money per year that they could use to hire someone to help keep that child at home.
Right.
That has been frozen for 2 years.
Yeah, you mentioned that.
Yes.
it seems a cynical way to take care of a budgetary problem when you tackle children who and families who are otherwise too preoccupied and not empowered in terms of a voice for themselves to take your cuts from them.
Well, when we look at it, when I look at the families that I see on a day-to-day basis, you really cannot argue that they have very clear and extraordinary needs. These are things that weren't in their control. There are things that they certainly need help with, and we know that families who have those kinds of supports are able to maintain their children at home and have a better quality of life. And indeed, the government, when they developed that program, talked about wanting to maintain families at home, children with disabilities at home and in the community as opposed to in institutions. And that was a very progressive program at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that in the long run, it's going to save the government as well, because the per diem rate for keeping a child in hospital, or if a family breaks down and the parents can no longer cope physically or emotionally, that's a cost to the healthcare system.
So this is saving the health system money as well as helping the children, but the government doesn't seem willing to support it to realize all the savings that could be realized.
Sure, and certainly social programs are a very important resource for the health of families. And we talk about social determinants of health and some of the things that we're talking about in terms of housing and accessibility, and those kinds of things really help families to live a fuller, healthier quality of life.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I think it bodes well for their future health too, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
And so for future costs, to be very blunt about it, costs to the healthcare system.
Yes. I think that if we were to really look ahead and plan ahead for the future, that having these kinds of things available to families in terms of their environment, in terms of their ability to participate fully in the community, is going to be a lot better for them and then for the system as a whole, as you said.
For the community. Yeah.
Now let's take a short break. This is Hal Singer and the Disc Jockey Boogie. Thank you.
I've mentioned that I thought that the government seemed to be applying an old standard of the provincial government, not the federal government, but the provincial government seems to be applying an old standard of disability, whereby you bear the visible stigma of a cognitive deficit, such as Down syndrome, whatever, or you're missing a limb or limbs. But if you have other problems, and you mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome as an example, then they're not so willing to accommodate it. And it's kind of hard to distinguish between when they're not aware and when they're trying to save money. And in the end, you have to wonder if they're trying not to know because they know that will save them money in the short run. And I'm very uncomfortable with that.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have experienced the same kind of thing in terms of the definition of disability for some of these programs and eligibility for some of these programs. And you mentioned fetal alcohol syndrome or fetal alcohol effects, people with acquired brain injuries. These are often hidden disabilities, and
yeah,
if you can broaden the definition of disability or people who have different abilities and looking in terms of their actual day-to-day function and participation in terms of defining it around participation, then you look at, you know, things like ability to make decisions, money management, impulse control, as we had talked about earlier. Those things are ways to describe an individual's ability to be fully able to participate in their family and in their community. And that could really make more people eligible for some of these extra supports, financial supports, also supports around having people, respite workers and respite care, where families can get a break, but also people can get that extra set of hands in to help them with activities of daily living, keeps them really healthier longer and improves their quality of life.
Would you say then that one of the solutions to this problem is amending the provincial definition of disability and how it's applied?
I think that's something that we would like to see broadened. We certainly serve also children with autism.
Right.
And those children sometimes are not able to access some of the services that others in the community that are defined as disabled.
Yeah, so you mentioned Wheel-Trans.
Wheel-Trans, absolutely. There's certainly groups that are looking at trying to broaden the definition to include others in that so that they're able to access transportation, which is certainly, you know, a huge way that people are able to participate in life.
Well, we have an election coming up in October of 2011. Do these groups see any signs of progress as that election draws nearer in making this a plank in any party's platform?
I don't know if this necessarily applies, but I think when we go back to the area of housing, we certainly are looking to all levels of government to try to come together and develop a plan. And there is, when I was speaking the other day, it was at a rally for looking at affordable housing and looking at the federal government amending their basic laws around human rights and including housing as a basic human right, therefore asking the federal government to take some responsibility and apply some financial support to ensure that all Canadians really do have a roof over their head, but not just a roof, but that it's quality, it's affordable, and it's, in our cases, the definition of accessible, so that people live in safe accommodations where they can safely move around and navigate in their own home to participate with their family and to have access to their washrooms and all of the things that are very important.
So you see one of the solutions to this concern is a stronger role for the federal government in a partnership in addressing these issues.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. And particularly housing.
Housing, so important. And, you know, the federal, the provincial, the municipal governments, they, for them to work cooperatively together on this would be, you know, would really make a difference. As I said, that many of these families are waiting over 12 years, or you said 15 years, for affordable housing, and there are many other vulnerable groups that have been waiting for affordable housing. They're putting a tremendous amount of their income, over 30, sometimes over 50 and more percent of their income, towards paying for housing. So as you know, there are many individuals and families that are existing and paying for the other basic necessities out of whatever is left.
I should probably point out for anyone who's listening that when we're talking of people paying 50% of their income for housing, we're probably talking about people making less or receiving less than $2,000 a month and spending $1,000 or more of it on housing. And so we're not talking about somebody making $70,000 a year and having only $35,000 left over. We're talking about somebody making $20,000 to $24,000 a year and having $1,000 a month left over. So that while the fraction, half of your income for housing, is certainly a sign for financial trouble and all kinds of other health and social problems ahead, it's far more severe than it sounds.
That's right. When you're on a low income and you're paying a lot of that, that minimal income that you do receive towards your shelter costs, then, you know, you're not going to be able to buy the food that you need, the healthy foods. You're not going to have the choices, and therefore, and feed your children in the way that you would like to. So, absolutely, that is the way things sometimes are for people, and I think, I'm not sure we mentioned that. We think it's about a third of the population of families with children with disabilities are within that Statistics Canada low income cutoff when it comes to income. So certainly there's many families that are doing quite well and managing. However, there is a percentage that certainly are struggling, and there hasn't been any new housing stock, new developments, for a number of years, really since the 70s and 80s, when there was more money put into, I think, social programs in general from the government.
Yeah.
At this point in time, we really want the voices of our families to be heard in some way.
Yeah. And you mentioned that you think it should be the federal representatives that hear these voices. So perhaps one step that anybody who's concerned about this issue could take is to draw it to the attention of their federal MP.
Absolutely.
Because we have an election coming up there soon, too.
Absolutely. And if anyone has the ability to do that, and if they know of anyone, of a family.
I think if you can afford a stamp, you have the ability.
Absolutely. you know,
in fact, at federal MP, you don't need a stamp.
Right.
So you need an envelope and a piece of paper and a pen.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And we certainly, that would be important if you are a family with the children with a child with a disability, or if you know of families, this is certainly an area that we think is important. Now, that's not to say that there are not existing programs that are being offered through the government that are available and that are very helpful and significant to many families. And there are programs, and we talked about the Assisted Devices Program, and that is something when a family is accessing, for example, their monthly disability assistance to children with disabilities, if they're able to access that and their child needs a wheelchair, the Ministry of Health, which funds the Assisted Devices Program, pays 75%, and the disability benefit through the Ministry of Community and Social Services pays for the remaining 25%.
Oh, very good.
So that's wonderful. And they pay for some other forms of equipment, which makes life a lot easier for families. It's the families that don't qualify for the disability benefit that are just above that cutoff.
Yeah.
That they're the ones that are having to find ways to make up that 25%. And then there is the Ontario March of Dimes that has a home and vehicle modification program. The Easter Seals Society does a lot for families in terms of providing help with accessibility with ramps and bath aids and other kinds of orthotics. So that's very helpful. You know, those programs do exist. So I have to say there are programs out there, and then there are some private foundations, as we mentioned, that have been extremely helpful, such as President's Choice Children's Charity and the Jennifer Ashley Children's Charity, and they are very helpful in augmenting some of those government programs. But, you know, those pots are only, you know, they only go so far, and they don't have all the funds in the world to cover everyone's needs.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Was there anything else that you wanted to say about the solution to this problem being bringing the federal government in?
Well,
do you think it goes further than that?
Well, I think that you had mentioned attitudes, and I think what you're doing today is really raising awareness,
mm-hmm,
and educating people in regards to some of the needs of individuals, and in particular my focus today on families with disabled children, so that people become, so that they're thinking, and when they, in terms of their planning and their design in terms of communities and in terms of housing, and that's one step in the right direction.
All right.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Well, I really appreciate your perspective today, and you've shed light on a subject that I realized when I read your quote I didn't know as much about as I thought, and thought maybe a listener might feel the same way. So thank you for your gift of understanding and your substantial gift of time.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for your interest in this topic, and we really appreciate it.
All right. Well, we'll air this on Thursday at noon on 93.3.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks, Barb.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read to you. The stories are in the newspapers that we mention after each item. These are condensations or abridgments of each news story for you on Disrespect. Unions set to negotiate as protests wane. Mass street and labor protests against pension reform in France appeared to lose momentum as the Senate approved the final version of the proposed bill, and trade unions looked to switch to other less disruptive tactics. Unions said they will seek to negotiate changes that will reduce unemployment among youth and older workers, a key concern for many of the protesters. The law working its way through Parliament raises the minimum retirement age by 2 years to 62 as of 2018, but it provides for another review of the pension system in 2013, a year after the next presidential election. At the height of protests, one-third of service stations had run short of fuel or were closed. High school and university students also staged demonstrations. Several ended in clashes with police after youth smashed windows and set fire to bus shelters. Youth unemployment runs as high as 25% in some parts of France. France also has one of the lowest rates of employment among senior workers in Europe. Just 38% are still employed when they turn 58. And that from the Globe and Mail, Anita Elash in Paris. G20 security called dangerous to democracy. The security response at the G20 summit in Toronto, where police arrested more than 1,000 protesters, raises fundamental questions about the health of democracy in this country, said the Canadian Civil Liberties Association. It was a sad weekend for civil liberties in Canada. We can do better, Natalie DeRosier, the general counsel for the National Advocacy Group, told the Commons Public Safety Committee. The committee is investigating security response to the summit last June, which saw rioting in downtown Toronto streets and mass arrests of about 1,100 people, with all but 100 eventually being let go. Space and mobility were redefined. Weaponry was redefined. Privacy was redefined, DeRosier told MPs, noting that while such redefinitions may have been necessary, they were done behind closed doors without any input from the public. Conditions inside the detention center were dehumanizing and humiliating, said Jacinthe Poisson, who was arrested during a mass arrest at a University of Toronto residence on the final day of the summit, June 27th. Her eyeglasses and her cellular phone were confiscated during the arrest, and she did not receive them again for 3 days, she said. We all had to sleep on the floor next to one another to try to stay warm, and the light was on very bright, 24 hours a day, so I slept very little, said Poisson of conditions inside the detention center on Eastern Avenue in Toronto. We were in cages. It is healthy in a democratic society to have people expressing their views, even if they're not the government's views, said Poisson, a sentiment that was later echoed by de Rosier. The moment that our international leaders can meet in Toronto and there are no members of the public to say, yes, we agree with you, or no, we don't agree, we will have lost democracy, de Rosier said. That from the Toronto Star, Ottawa Bureau, Joanna Smith. Passenger told he's too disabled to fly on his own. A motivational speaker with cerebral palsy said he was humiliated when he was kicked off a U.S. Airways flight after being told he was too disabled to fly alone. Johnny Title, 47, told the Grand Rapids Press, "By denying me the ability to fly, I couldn't do my job." Title of Grand Rapids Township, Michigan, said he has flown more than 800,000 kilometers to give speeches, but he missed one September 23rd because of the incident in Florida. After helping him into his seat aboard a flight from West Palm Beach to Kansas City, a U.S. Airways gate agent returned and wheeled Title back to the terminal, he said. He told me I could fly on U.S. Airways if I could find a companion to go with me because I was a danger to myself and others if something went wrong, Title told WZZM-TV. Trust me, they made a mistake. U.S. Airways spokeswoman Valerie Wonder said the gate agent was following company policy. The airline requires that the passenger has to be physically able to assist himself or herself in the event of an emergency, she said. Title said he's contacted U.S. Airways officials and plans to meet with them in coming weeks to discuss his concerns with the company policy. That from the Star, Byline Associated Press. Canadian hurt in bus hijacking wakes from coma. After waking from a nearly two-month coma, Jason Leung identified his mother and has since been trying to perform simple tasks like reading, watching television, and surfing the internet, according to the South China Morning Post. A disgruntled former police officer commandeered a bus carrying Hong Kong tourists, including the Leung family, in the Philippine capital, Manila, on August 23rd. Millions around the world watched on live TV as police commandos exchanged fire with hostage taker Rolando Mendoza after day-long negotiations broke down. Eight people from Hong Kong died before Mendoza was killed by a sniper. The father, Ken, died trying to subdue the gunman who then killed his two daughters, Doris, 21, and Jessie, 14. The only survivors were the mother, Amy, and 18-year-old son, Jason, who fell into a coma after suffering a head wound that still hasn't been explained. Dr. Dawson Fong said that Jason would have another operation by the end of this year to replace part of his skull removed to relieve intracranial pressure, the English Daily Paper in Hong Kong reported. Fong, however, cautioned that Jason's motor functions are still restricted and he has a long way to go before standing up. That from the Star, bylined Min Lee, Associated Press. Trapped on the rock, paralyzed man seeks return to Toronto. For more than 25 years, Andy March dreamt of one day moving back to Botwood, Newfoundland, the small seaport town where he was born and raised until he was 13. So when the now 58-year-old Acton man was laid off from his job as a painter at the outset of the recession of 2008, he finally decided to take the plunge and headed east for a fresh start. But on a June night a few months later, a nasty fall left him a quadriplegic, and in a fleeting moment, the dream he left Ontario to chase became an inescapable nightmare. He said the thought of returning to Ontario and being close to his daughters and his two grandsons is what keeps him going when he's feeling down. However, moving 3,000 kilometers across the country is easier said than done when you're in a wheelchair and in need of round-the-clock care. March says he waited for months for a bed to open up at the E.W. Bickel Center on Dunn Avenue, and he was supposed to move in at the beginning of September. Now March says he's been told he's no longer a candidate for the Parkdale Area Center. March said the trouble stems from an incident involving a nurse in June. He had just been hoisted into his wheelchair, which he says was left switched on to its high speed. He says he bumped the control stick, causing his chair to accidentally jump forward and crash into the nurse. Apparently, a report was sent from the Miller Center alerting Toronto Rehab that March had intentionally hurt the staffer. The police investigated, but nothing came of it, March said, adding he was ordered to undergo anger management sessions. Although Charo March is her dad's power of attorney, she said she hasn't been able to get anyone to tell her what's going on. My understanding is they won't take him now because they don't have a psychologist on site to accommodate the anger issues they claim he has, she said. Spokesman for Toronto Rehab and for the Miller Center refused to comment, citing privacy issues. His ex-wife Kelly, who remains close friends with her ex-husband, said he should be here with the people who love him. And that story by Chris Doucette from the Toronto Sun. Family MDs clash over resuscitation order. Man Ki Lee, a 46-year-old Toronto accountant and father of two young boys, wants doctors to use all medical measures possible to save him in the event of a life-threatening emergency. He made those intentions clear to his doctors at Sunnybrook Health Sciences Center when he entered the hospital in August. He wrote it in a power of attorney document and then confirmed it in a videotaped statement, his lawyers say. While his doctor initially agreed to respect those wishes, physicians unilaterally reversed the decision without consultation and imposed a do-not-resuscitate order, his family alleges. Julie Chi, Lee's wife, says she was shocked to learn doctors had decided to withhold emergency treatment without even giving us a heads-up. The hospital and its doctors, meanwhile, argue the ultimate decision on whether to resuscitate a patient rests on physician judgment rather than patient wishes. This is the second end-of-life case involving a Sunnybrook patient to reach the courts in the past month. They both pose a highly charged question that inhabits a legal and ethical gray area in Canada. When patients and their families disagree with doctors over life-saving treatment, who decides? Lawyers for Lee, the hospital, and the two doctors treating him sought an order from a Superior Court judge clarifying just what should happen if Lee's life falls into question. Madam Justice Barbara Ann Conway effectively revoked the do-not-resuscitate order imposed by Sunnybrook physicians that made it clear that it didn't compel them to actually resuscitate Lee in case of emergency, leaving the matter to their own judgment. The court order lifting the do-not-resuscitate order is likely a precedent in Canada, said Barry Swadron, the lawyer arguing the case in court for Lee's family. It is a recognition by the Superior Court that physicians should not be making do-not-resuscitate orders without first obtaining consent of patients or substitute decision-makers. Lee is currently in and out of consciousness and unaware that his wish for life-saving care is being denied by doctors, his family says. The end-of-life arguments in the case couldn't be more polarized. Last month, The Star reported on the case of Douglas Daguerre, another Sunnybrook patient who requested full emergency care, which was changed by doctors without consultation, according to allegations filed in court by his daughter. His daughter, Joy Wardziniak, says she pleaded with doctors to save her father's life as he was in critical condition 2 years ago. They stood back and refused as he suffered an arrest, she alleges. He passed away moments later. That case remains before the courts. Sunnybrook officials declined to comment. Quote, there needs to be far more communication between doctors and patients and substitute decision makers, and I think we need to clarify the law on whether or not doctors are unilaterally entitled to withhold treatment that does not meet a purely medical standard of care, said Mark Handelman, one of Lee's lawyers and a trained bioethicist who specializes in health care. I agree that doctors do not have to propose treatments that they think are not appropriate or to which they have a moral objection. but I think they need to be more careful about what they propose or do not propose. And that story was from The Star, Robert Cribb, staff reporter. And now it's time for a short break with Dr. John, the honey dripper. Food fight over chow in prison. The Rock serves salmon while Toronto inmates scrape by on lettuce. In Toronto, lunch served to inmates at courthouses, most of whom are awaiting trial and presumed innocent, consists of a sandwich, often cheese, and a glass of water mixed with artificial flavor crystals. Vegetarians get a piece of lettuce and a slice of tomato on a hamburger bun. The Toronto Police Service, which is responsible for the lunches, pays $1.19 per meal. A lawyer representing the alleged president of the Toronto's Hells Angels plans to challenge the adequacy of the meals, asking a judge to order that his client be provided with more to eat and drink during his four-month trial. My client is presumed innocent and has a right to defend himself against the charges at his trial. Craig Bottomley, a lawyer representing John Neal, told The Star, "It's impossible for him to do so if all he can focus on is the fact that he is starving. In absolute dollars, the city spends more on feeding Toronto's zoo animals than accused people, $927,000 a year, according to the zoo's website, versus approximately $200,000 for inmates. In fact, lunches served to accused people in Toronto courthouses may well be the most nutritionally inadequate in North America. Adequate food and drink for prisoners is considered a basic right in domestic and international law, Bottomley said in court documents, but Toronto courthouse lunches fail to meet Health Canada standards or United Nations rules for the treatment of prisoners, he argues. He also suggests they violate his client's right to be treated in accordance with principles of fundamental justice under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And that byline, Tracy Tyler, legal affairs reporter for the Star. His death was a result of his service. Corporal Stuart Langridge had left Afghanistan more than a year earlier, but on March 15, 2008, he hanged himself in his barracks at Canadian Forces Base Edmonton. "Sorry, I can't take it anymore. Please know that I needed to stop the pain," Langridge wrote. His mother, Sheila Fines, longs for the day when she can grieve for her son. But in the years since Langridge killed himself, Fines says she's been too busy battling a military bureaucracy. "We actually have yet to grieve. We shuffle paper. We make phone calls. We go to meetings," Fines said. "Odd as it sounds, I'm actually looking forward to the day that I get to just sit and start grieving for my son in a normal manner," she said. Of all the missteps, the fact the military withheld his suicide note from the family for 14 months stings the most. He returned home suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, a psychological condition seen in soldiers who have served in a battle zone. Langridge's mental health rapidly deteriorated after his return to Canada. In the last year of his life, he attempted suicide 6 times, was hospitalized several times, and had resorted to alcohol and cocaine. Fine said her 28-year-old son was never properly treated for his stress disorder and says the decisions made by the military medical staff during the last weeks of his life were thoughtless, humiliating, and destabilizing. The Armed Forces' own ombudsman brought these matters to the attention of the Minister of National Defense many months ago. Pierre Daigle said it was inconceivable that the military continues to ignore recommendations aimed at helping military families cope. The outcry sparked a quick response from Defense Minister Peter MacKay, who claimed he only learned about Fine's concerns, even though she had been battling his department for more than 2 years. MacKay said he's instructed senior officials to contact Fine's, adding, "We intend to address this situation in a timely fashion." That by Bruce Campion Smith, Ottawa Bureau Chief of the Toronto Star. Natinjik apologizes to family of dead soldier. Post-traumatic stress disorder led to 2008 suicide. In an about-face, Chief of the Defense Staff General Walter Natinjik issued a partial apology to the family of a soldier who killed himself while suffering post-traumatic stress syndrome. A veteran of Bosnia and Afghanistan, Corporal Langridge, suffered from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder after returning from Afghanistan, eventually killing himself at Canadian Forces Base Edmonton in 2008. Since his death, the Fines say the forces have performed a character assassination on their son, spinning his alcohol and drug abuse as addictions rather than possible symptoms and coping mechanisms associated with PTSD. His mother said she has been trying since March to get the Department of National Defense to return her son's pension contributions to his estate. Months of phone calls yielded few answers. Instead, the soldier's mother was ordered in a letter dated September 21st to stop phoning the Ottawa offices of the military's pension branch. In the House of Commons, Defense Minister Peter MacKay said he was outraged by the case. "This is unacceptable," he said. "We should never refuse access to members of the military or their families when addressing these important matters." That from the National Post, Friday, October 29th. Byline, Amy Minsky and David Pugliese.
It is one thing to apologize to the family of Corporal Stuart Langridge for DND's bungling of his estate, the mishandling of his records, and for keeping his suicide note at bay, but quite another for ignoring how badly the military treated Langridge while he was so obviously suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. Natinjik, however, refused to go there, and for that he deserves to be castigated. Instead of assassinating Langridge's character, as his family has accused DND of doing, DND should be blaming its own chain of command for gawking from the sidelines and doing nothing. They knew they had a sick soldier. Truth is, Langridge had attempted suicide several times before hanging himself in his barracks at Canadian Forces Base Edmonton in 2008. How many red flags are needed? Due to our combat role in Afghanistan, upwards of 40% of returning soldiers suffer varying degrees of the debilitating disorder. Sun Media has written extensively about how PTSD is not only sweeping through the armed forces, often resulting in homelessness, substance abuses, and suicide, but how it is also gripping police forces and first responders across the country in similar fashion. There is an elephant in the room when it comes to our military, our police, and our EMS crews, and it is PTSD. Defense Minister Peter McKay promised we will remedy this matter. Before anything can be remedied, however, McKay must force the military to face the fact that PTSD within its ranks cannot simply be machoed off as mere weakness. PTSD is real, and it is destructive, not a figment of imaginations. And that in an editorial from the Toronto Sun. And in a sign of perhaps better days ahead, the Supreme Court of Canada bolstered press freedom Friday by ruling that journalists in Quebec can keep the names of confidential sources secret if doing so is in the public interest. This means that a journalist has the right to protect an anonymous source if a court is convinced public interest outweighs demand for the writer to reveal the name. The ruling concerned an anonymous source who provided Globe and Mail reporter Daniel LeBlanc with information for stories about corruption in the federal sponsorship program, a scandal that led to demands to clean up Ottawa. The case arose from a lawsuit filed by the federal government against advertising firm Group Polygon to recoup $35 million in sponsorship money paid by the former Liberal government. The Quebec Superior Court ordered LeBlanc to answer questions from Polygon's lawyers about his sources. The reporter did not do so, and the Globe launched an appeal to the Supreme Court. But it was only a partial victory for LeBlanc because the Supreme Court referred the case back to the Quebec judicial system, and he will have to await another decision by the Quebec Superior Court. The four-point test the Supreme Court wants to see used in Quebec seeks to establish that the source was assured he or she would remain anonymous, that such anonymity is vital to the journalist-source relationship, that the confidential relationship is in the public interest, and that this public interest is greater than the need for disclosure. And that from the Star, Ottawa Bureau, Les Whittington. That's all the news we have, really, this week. But come back next week, you know we will have more. To take us out, Pine Top Perkins. Take it easy, baby.
Treat my baby right. You better take it easy. You better take it easy, baby. You better take it easy, mama, 'cause I can't stand the way you do. The girl I love is built for speed. She got everything that a daddy needs. You better take it easy. Take it easy, baby. You better take it easy, mama, 'cause I can't stand the way you do. Better take it easy.
to do to change your mind? You keep me worried about it all the time. You better take it easy. Take it easy, baby. You better take it easy, baby, because I can't stand the way you do. Leave it this time, ain't coming back no more. Always saying that it's lonely and good. You better take it easy. Take it easy, baby. You better take it easy, mama, because I can't stand the way you do.
You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.msumcmaster.ca. You can email us at dialogue, D-I-A-L-O-G-U-E, at radio.fm. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number 4, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.